the road site, which I ultimately came to regard as not a road at all, takes the form of a huge reversed letter J. Its longer arm, about 1,900 feet in length, is compounded of two parallel rows of megalithic blocks that terminate against a wider pavement-like section of somewhat smaller blocks. The pavement section turns through a 90-degree arc toward the beach, a half-mile distant. Extending the pavement a short distance brings you to two parallel rows about 327 feet long, which make up the shorter arm of the J. At length, a clue to the order of the blocks emerged when we found what we have since called the, quote, square stone, end quote, about 8 by 10 feet in size on the 1,900-foot lead. When I first photographed this stone, it was clear that the block was surrounded by joints which rested against it on all sides, like a stone set into enormous masonry. For the newcomer to the site, it is probably the most compelling suggestion of the work of man. Why this order existed was yet to be discovered. However, we noted the artificial or apparent artificial arrangement of these stones and went on to explore further. Go over here, Peter. Here's an aerial view of the roadside, showing the reverse J formation of the blocks underwater. That's underwater, that's not on land. From the first, our attention was drawn to the shorter leg of the J. And here, by the way, is the square stone. From the first, our attention was drawn to the shorter leg of the J, particularly to that area nearest the beach because of the stone's great regularity. The beachward row also included one block, perhaps 12 feet square, one edge of which had somehow been lifted up from the seabed and now rested against an adjacent block. We wondered at the fact that these blocks were not joined to the underlying bedrock. The obvious answer was that they were not originally shaped where they now rested. Not wishing to explore this any further at the moment, we contented ourselves with photographing the blocks, emphasizing the joints. Several days later, we turned our attention to the east site, perhaps as large as 100 acres. Its southern edge is bordered by what appears to be a dike, with parallel rows of rectangular shapes extending several hundred yards. Our aerial photographs show hydraulic action from tidal currents diverted by this dike. The shape, in reality, is formed by turtle grass, which could have covered stones which once lay below and have since dissolved. Our speculation was that this site may have been an ancient reservoir. And here's a picture of the current produced by the dike on the east side. Our curiosity whetted, my wife Joan and I decided to fly to Nassau for an aerial view of the temple at Andros Island reported by Trigg Adams and Robert Brush in 1968. We could see it clearly during the Chalk Airline flight, and its distance from the shore seemed to argue against its recent construction by man. Yet, just the year before, John Kiesler, a reporter for the Miami News, had interviewed 55-year-old Reuben Russell, constable on Andros Island, who claimed he had helped build the structure in the 1930s for a Nassau man who used it as a holding pen for sponges awaiting shipment. Dr. Valentine and others found 11 more geometric shapes around the northern waters of Andros Island, including a hexagon, parallel lines, and a semicircle on one end of a straight line. Also visible is a huge reversed E. Since these represent a variety of patterns, it does not seem reasonable to claim that they were all sponge pens. Just before finishing our 5 weeks of research in the Bahamas, we ran a pathometer profile over the two shorter rows of blocks at Paradise Point to determine the plane of the seabed. Our findings showed that the bottom was parallel to the water's surface, not sloping. Since beach rock is usually formed on a slope, this seemed to argue against the blocks being beach rock or naturally formed on the site. The upshot of our work in 1974 was a growing feeling among us that the so-called road site was not a natural formation, but could instead have been engineered by man. The straightness of its 1,900-foot length suggested the precision of a survey. The order of the various rows of blocks, the fact that they were not attached to the seafloor, our chart work that showed their overall orientation about 7 degrees out of alignment from the present beach line, all led us to conclude that we were very likely dealing with an underwater archaeological site. If Dr. Valentine's theory of Bimini as a megalithic site were valid, perhaps it would be a good idea to find a specialist in this field to join us in the search. Now, here is a diagram of the J formation. With pathometer readings that I don't expect you or I, either one, to be able to understand. On the eve of the 1975 expedition to Bimini, we were sitting in La Joint, a popular waterfront restaurant in Miami, listening to archaeologist John Steele, in his early 30s, dressed in modish attire, describe megalithic sites in England and Ireland. A veteran of Dr. Maxine Asher's 1973 underwater expedition seeking evidence of Atlantis off the coast of Spain, John had flown over from a lecturer's post at University College in London. His background also included involvement in scientific projects founded by NASA and the National Science Foundation, and he had just presented a paper with John Mitchell, the British expert on megalithic sites, for an English symposium on ancient energy. John, who had yet to visit Bimini, suddenly turned and asked me, "Do you really think it's a megalithic site as Valentine has claimed?" Answer: seems that way. What we've seen so far favors the man-made theory. Question: what's your theory about the function of the Bimini road site? I explained that I didn't think it was a road, but due to its shape, more likely related to some ancient harbor works. John felt that whatever its function, the mere presence of such large worked stones certainly didn't fit in with any known culture pattern of the Bahamas. He proceeded to review the basic features of megalithic sites. Megaliths, or huge stones, are elements of prehistoric monuments and architecture. Each stone or monolith is found either standing as a menhir, single upright stone, in circular patterns around a mound, or supporting a capstone, and thus a dolmen. They may be either natural or partly curved or dressed, Because bones, tools, and apparent offerings have been found in some of the dolmens, those that have a cap. Here's a dolmen, for example. Because bones, tools, and apparent offerings have been found in some of the dolmens, it is felt that they, and perhaps all megalithic sites, were once tombs, at least in part. You know, it's been said when you can't explain something, you give God credit for it. Well, that would seem to be better than when you can't explain something, calling it a tomb. John pointed out that one of the intriguing aspects of megalithic sites is the size and weight of both their natural and arranged stones. The Egyptians, for example, used 70-ton granite blocks in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. The Egyptians. At Stonehenge, one of the huge standing stones within the circle has a total height above and below ground of 29 feet 6 inches and weighs about 50 tons. In France, the great Menhir at Loch Mariacre, once erected as a monolith and now in four pieces on the ground, measures 77 feet and weighs over 300 tons. The controversial Mystery Hill megalithic site in New Hampshire includes stones weighing over 6 tons. The larger blocks at Bimini are probably about 15 tons. The sheer size and weight of these stones raises many difficult questions. Sometimes they are superbly carved and shaped, often a part of superior masonry construction, which compounds the puzzle of their origin. The explanations that they were fashioned by stone implements or hardened bronze tools are convincing enough until you actually inspect them closely. And most people who believe that haven't inspected them. Their intricacy of design seems far beyond what rudimentary tools could accomplish. I realize that John, like myself, used the term megalithic in a broader sense to include New World sites like Tiahuanaco in Bolivia and Machu Picchu in Peru. Some of the carved stones at Tiahuanaco, for example, weigh in on the order of several hundred tons. The rougher monolithic stones in the main temple are as tall as 9.5 feet. Here's a good picture of Stonehenge, by the way. Approaching the nearly 14-foot height of Stonehenge is great trilithons. See that picture again, without my cigar in it. The most important thing about megalithic culture is our recent awareness that these, or their amazing structures, are based on a much more evolved science than either Neolithic or Bronze Age man was ever thought to possess. That's what I said. Built into their architecture are sophisticated astronomical alignments such as solar and lunar risings and settings. From the ground level, Stonehenge is the most impressive of the European megalithic sites. The more that is learned about it, the less is understood of its origins, functions, or the unaccountable plan of its master builders. Whoever constructed Stonehenge had a surprising awareness of aesthetics. The Sarsen, or sandstone, that's the name, Sarsen lintled circle, which the visitor first sees from the road, gives evidence of an architectural technique common in the columns of classical Greek temples. To correct the effects of perspective, the Sarsen stones, which taper in as they rise, are also curved convexly. How did this level of cultural awareness find its way to England's Salisbury Plain during the Stone Age? That's what I said. Gerald Hawkins, who successfully attacked the problem of Stonehenge with modern computers, worked from a photogrammetric survey to establish the possible sighting lines of astronomical phenomena with greater accuracy than anyone had before, and it's Hawkins' work with his computer that is drawn upon by Gaunt in the book on Stonehenge that we've been reading the past week. Hawkins fed this and astronomical data into a computer and discovered that Stonehenge provided sighting arrangements for the sun at the times of the equinoxes and solstices, and also for the extremes of the moon. He made the further startling discovery that the site could be used as a computer to predict lunar eclipses. Since this time, still more accurate surveys directed by Alexander Thom have reinforced the lunar eclipse prediction idea. By 1974, I warn you,
yes, sir,
the year of my first expedition to Bimini, the new discipline of archaeoastronomy had established itself to the extent that an astronomer writing in Science magazine could say, quote, "The solstitial alignments of Stonehenge and other European megalithic monuments, of Egyptian pyramids and temples and of Mayan temples are by now generally recognized." The writer John A. Eddy, at work on an American Stonehenge, the Medicine Wheel, and the Bighorn Mountains of northern Wyoming, had moved off to more sophisticated astronomical phenomena, the heliacal risings of stars. A heliacal rising, important to the ancients for calendrical purposes, occurs when a star rises momentarily before sunrise and is then extinguished by the light of a pre-dawn sky. The Egyptians used the heliacal rising of Sirius to help time the summer solstice that signaled the annual rise of the Nile. The annual flooding of the Nile, or the fields by the Nile, was necessary for productive agriculture, but the people required warnings to take to the safety of the hills. Eddy's investigations led him to claim that in Wyoming, the summer solstitial observation was accompanied by the heliacal rising of Aldebaran, the bright star in Taurus. Obviously, solar and lunar risings and settings, the meridian transits of stars, the heliacal rising of stars, and even predictions of eclipses were important observation for ancient astronomers who incorporated these phenomena into their megalithic structures. Here's a diagram of the Bighorn Medicine Wheel laid alongside the diagram of Stonehenge, which by now you're very familiar with the sighting to the summer solstice across the Healstone. Because there is so little evidence about megalithic culture, every new site presents exciting possibilities, particularly when it is found on another continent. Now remember, Josephus spoke of the descendants of Seth building two time capsules. All that really proves is that he knew of two. It also proves he didn't know about three or four or five, but doesn't prove that three, four, or five didn't exist, or more. Because there is so little evidence about megalithic culture, every new site presents exciting possibilities, particularly when it's found on another continent. New Hampshire's Mystery Hill, once believed to have been built by a 19th century farmer, includes stones of over 6 tons. That marked the summer and winter solstices, big farmers in the 19th century. You want me to continue teaching on this subject or not?